Side 11, The Boat of a Million Years by Powell Anderson, continuing on page 315.
I'm afraid that's what I'll mainly be doing.
The other man drew a sheet of paper from his briefcase and consulted the notes on it. Kenneth Alexander Tannehill was born August 25, 1933, in Troy, Vermont, a little town near the Canadian border. His parents moved away shortly afterward. A former neighbor, to whom they wrote a couple of letters, said they'd gone to Minnesota, but he couldn't remember precisely where. A Northwoods hamlet. Everything shadowy. Nothing on record, but the bare minimum of official stuff and a few old stories in an upstate newspaper. Excitement tingled in Moriarty.
Do you mean this could be an assumed identity? Suppose the real Tannehills all died, say in an accident.
A man with money who wanted to cover his tracks could set a detective agency to locating such a deceased family, one that suited his needs.
Maybe, Stoddard sounded skeptical. Damn hard to prove. Draft records from before the end of conscription?
I'd rather not try springing anything like that loose for you, Senator.
No, I suppose not, unless we can turn up clues that justify to the proper authorities.
Tannehill has never claimed he was ever in the service. We got that much. But a lot of men his age never were, in spite of Korea and Vietnam, for a variety of reasons. He's given no hints as to why he wasn't. It isn't that he acts evasive or secretive. Associates describe him as a genial sort, with a ready fund of jokes and quips, though he does require competence from his employees, and gets it. He simply has a knack for turning conversation away from himself.
He would.
Go on.
Never married, I believe.
No.
Not homosexual or impotent. There have been a few women over the years whom we've identified. Nothing especially serious, and none of them bear him any grudge.
Too bad.
What kind of trail has he left on the West Coast?
Essentially zilch.
He first surfaced in New Hampshire, bought his house and grounds, started his magazine, all as a... not exactly an employee of Tomek Enterprises. Associate or agent might be a better word. At any rate, Tomek finances him, and I guess that a lot of his trips are for purposes of reporting back to the old man.
He's pretty shadowy himself, isn't he?
Moriarty stroked his chin. It puffed out a bit under his fingers. I've been thinking more and more that that line might well be worth pursuing.
Senator, my advice to you is to drop this whole business. It's expensive as hell. It takes up staff time you badly need in an election year, and I'm 99% convinced it could never produce anything politically useful.
Do you think I am only a politician, Hank?
I've heard you describe your ideals.
Moriarty reached decision.
You're right, we can't go on chasing ghosts. At the same time, I feel it in my bones. Something here won't bear the light of day. Yes, I have personal motivations, too. Exposing it would be a coup, and I'm sick of Tannehill's baiting and want to lash back. We'll have to leave off the effort to get background information, I suppose. But I won't give up entirely.
He bridged his fingers and peered over them.
Where is he at the moment?
Stoddard shrugged.
Someplace this side of the moon, probably.
Moriarty bit his lip. The chart room had been extra vicious about the decline of the American space program.
Well, he'll have to come back eventually. I want his house and his office under surveillance. When he does show up, I want a 24-hour tail on him. Understand?
Stoddard began to form an answer, swallowed it, and nodded.
Can do if you don't mind paying what it costs.
I have money, Moriarty said.
My own, if necessary.
8.
What is wrong?
Natalia Thurlow's question cut, or probed, like a sword early in an engagement. Hanno realized that she would no longer be denied. Nonetheless, he stood for a while yet, staring out of Robert Caldwell's living room window. The late summer dark had fallen. Where his body staved off reflections, he saw lights in their thousands, down the hill and through the lower city to the peace that lay mightily upon the waters. Thus had Syracuse basked in wealth and happiness, with the greatest mechanicians of the age to perfect her defenses, and meanwhile the austere Romans prepared themselves. "You came home yesterday like a man in a dream," Natalia went on at his back. "Then today you left practically at dawn and haven't returned till now, still locked up inside yourself." "I told you why," he said. "Business accumulated while I was gone." "What do you mean? Except for your interest in the Rufus lab, what do you do any longer locally?" The challenge made him turn around. She stood rigid, fists at her sides. The pain that he saw hurt him, too. The rising anger that he heard was a kind of balm. "You know I have things going elsewhere," he reminded her. She had seen the modest downtown office he maintained. He had never described just what it was for. "Indeed. Whenever I tried to call you, your machine answered. I had to get around. What did you want? I phoned the machine here to say you shouldn't wait dinner for me." In point of fact, throughout the day he had mostly been Joe Levine, briefing a couple of other attorney accountants on Charles Tomek's tax audit so that they could take over while he was gone for some unpredictable time on some unspecified matter. They already knew the general situation and many details, of course. No single agent could cope with Uncle Sam. And what did those hordes of paper shufflers produce that was of any value to any living soul? However, there were certain tricky points they needed to understand. At that, it could prove costly, leaving them to their own devices, not that they might reveal illegalities. None existed. Hanno knew better than to allow such a crack in his defenses against the state. But he couldn't explain to them why Mr. Tomek must not be found on his travels and brought back to help cope. Ephemera. Expendable. Svoboda would soon arrive, to be the fifth in the fellowship. And beyond her, despite himself, his pulse fluttered. "I thought we could meet for dinner at a restaurant," Natalia was saying. "Sorry, that wouldn't have worked. I grabbed a sandwich." Untrue. He could not have stayed calm in her company. He wasn't quite the poker player he had supposed. Maybe Svoboda had thawed something within him, or shaken it till it began to crack. "You refused me the reason you were so rushed, don't you?" Natalia sighed. "You're a wily one. Only now does it really dawn on me how little you've ever let slip about what you do, about anything meaningful that concerns you." "Look, let's not fight," he urged. "You know I'm a taciturn by nature." "No, you're not. That's the trouble. You talk and talk, glib, interesting. But aside from those Neanderthal politics of yours, how much do you seriously say?" Before he could reply, she raised a hand to hush him. "In spite of that, I've discovered how to read certain clues. Whoever you met in Denmark, it wasn't the promising subject you spoke of so vaguely. And then when we got home from the airport and you looked through the mail, that one letter in it that rocked you back, you couldn't completely hide your reaction. But I foresaw you wouldn't show it to me or speak a single word about it." Assuredly not, Hanno thought. Especially since Asa Gao, the naive little sweetheart, had penned it in her awkwardly precise English. "It's private. Confidential." "A person in Idaho, as well as Denmark? Damn." She'd noticed the return address. He should have cautioned the Asian pair about communicating with him. But they knew his Caldwell identity from the Rufus connection, and they were timid about the Tomek complex, an unfamiliar kind of thing where perhaps strangers would intercept messages, and it had never before occurred to him that they, of all people on Earth, might bumble onto a fresh scent. As it was, Natalia had been honorable and not steamed the envelope open. Well, he'd made sure of her character before taking up with her more than casually. Did he indeed understand her, though? She was a bright and complicated person. That was what had attracted him. She might have had fewer surprises to spring on him if he'd been more forthcoming with her. Too late now, he thought. The sadness that crossed him was half weariness. Even for a creature of his vitality, this had been an exhausting day. He roughened his language. Get off my back, will you? Neither of us owns the other. She stiffened further. No, you haven't wanted any commitment, have you? What am I to you besides a sexual convenience? Oh, for God's sake, stop this nonsense! He made a step in her direction. What we've had was splendid. Let's not ruin it. She stood unstirring, save that her eyes grew very wide. Was? She whispered. He had wanted to tell her in kindlier wise. Maybe this was better. I have to take off again. Not sure when I'll be back. Fly east, as Tannehill, engage a private detective to collect the basic information about those Unity people, take a few surreptitious photos, provide him the basis for deciding whether to approach them directly or not. Meanwhile, Svoboda would have wound up her affairs in Europe, obtained her visa and ticket, boarded a plane. She'd be landing in New York. The seclusion of the Tannehill property offered a chance to get genuinely acquainted, to catch up on the past millennium. And you won't tell me why, Natalia said, flat-voiced. I am sorry, but I can't. He had long since learned to avoid elaborate fictions. She looked past him, or through him. Another woman? Maybe. But more to it than that. Else you'd just cast me off. No, listen. Look, Nat. You're welcome to keep on living here. In fact, I hope you do, and... She shook her head. I have my pride. Her gaze sharpened. What are you up to? Who are you conspiring with, and why? I say again, this is a personal matter. Maybe it is, considering the attitudes you've expressed. I can't be sure. She lifted her hand anew. Oh, I won't go bearing tales, especially since you give me nothing to go on. But I've got to cover my ass. You understand that, don't you? If the cops ever question me, I'll tell them what little I know, because I don't owe you any loyalty any longer. Hey, wait! He reached to take hold of her. She warded him off. Let's sit down and have a drink and talk this out. She considered him. How much more will you actually have to say? I care about you and... Never mind. You can make up the hide a bed for yourself. I'll pack my things tomorrow. She went from him. I would have had to depart before long in any case. He could not cry after her. It should have been easier than this. At least I'll occupy no more of the years that are left you. He wondered if she, once alone tonight, would weep. 9. Rain fell slowly through windlessness, almost a mist. Its tarnished silver hid the slabs of apartment buildings and muffled every noise. There were only wet grass, dripping leaves, glimmer of marsh water along the walkway. Nobody else was about on such a midweek afternoon in northwest Copenhagen. Having left his place and gone the short distance to Utterslef Mosa Park, Peter Astrup and Olga Rasmussen had the world to themselves. Beneath his cap, droplets glinted on the round young face like tears. "But you cannot leave just like this," he pleaded. She looked straight ahead. Both her hands, after he let go, she had jammed into the pockets of her coat. "It is sudden," she admitted. "Brutally sudden. That's why I asked you to take the day off so I could meet you. Time is short, and I have much to do first. After I haven't seen or heard from you since..." He seized her arm. "What were you doing? Who have you been with?" She edged aside. He felt the unspoken command and released her. He was always gentle, she thought. Sympathetic, yes. He may be the sweetest lover I have ever had or ever will. "I don't want to hurt you more than I must, Peter," she said low. "This way seems best." "But what of our holiday in Finland?" He gulped. "Pardon me, that was an idiotic thing to ask. Now?" "Not really." She made herself regard him again. "I was looking forward the same as you. This opportunity, though, is too great." is it?" he demanded desperately. "To go herring off to America? And what? You haven't made that at all clear."
"It's confidential. Scientific research. I promised to say nothing about it. But you know how interested I am."
"Yes, your mind, your reach of knowledge.
I believe that drew me to you more than your beauty."
"Oh, come," she tried to laugh. "I realize I'm rather plain."
He stopped. Perforce, she did likewise. They faced each other in the chilly gray. Because he was still youthful, he blurted, "You are mysterious. You hide something. I know you do. And you are incomparable as a woman." "And Hanno," she thought, "has also passed many mortal lifetimes in learning."
I love you, Olga," Peter stammered. "I've told you before. I do again. Will you marry me? With papers and everything?"
"Oh, my dear," she murmured. "I'm old enough to be..." Abruptly she could not say, "your mother." Instead, "I am too old for you. I may not look it, but I have told you. We've enjoyed this past couple of years."
"We have, we have.
And Hanno, what do I truly know of Hanno? What can I await from him? He and I have both lived too long in secret. It has surely misshaped us in ways we don't feel. But he prowled the world for thrice the time that I abided in my Russia. He has been fascinating and challenging and, yes, fun. But already I have glimpsed a ruthlessness. Or is it an inward loneliness? How much is he able to care for anyone or for anything beyond naked survival?" Through the confusion, she heard herself finish, "We knew from the first that it couldn't last. Let's end it cleanly while it's still happy." He stood slumped.
"I don't care how old you are," he said. "I love you."
Exasperation stirred. "You're being babyish," she kept from saying. "Well, what could I expect from a person not yet 30? You have nothing left for me to discover."
"I'm sorry."
"No doubt I should have declined you at the beginning, but the flesh has its demands, and liaisons here are easy come, easy go. With Hanno and those others, is an immortal marriage possible? I don't think I'm actually in love with him yet, or he with me. Perhaps we never will be, but that's no foundation for an enduring partnership anyway. Certainly not by itself. We'll have to see what happens."
"We'll see what happens."
"Don't take it this hard," she said. "You'll get over it and find the right girl. And settle down to raise children who will grow up into the same comfortable narrowness and crumble into the same dust. Unless we are on the verge of fire and slaughter and a new dark age, as Hanno thinks we may well be." Svoboda smiled at Peter. "Meanwhile," she said quietly, "we might go back to your apartment and give ourselves a grand farewell. After all, it would only be until tomorrow."
10. Corinne Makandal received her caller in the Victorian living room. "How do you do?" she said, and offered her hand. His was sinewy, unexpectedly hard, the clasp light but firm. He bowed over hers with an archaic assurance. "Please be seated. Would you like a cup of coffee or tea?" Kenneth Tannehill kept his feet. "Thank you," he replied, "but could we please talk in confidence where nobody can overhear?" Surprised, she looked closer at him. Her immediate thought was, how old is he anyway? Black hair, smooth skin, supple frame spoke of youth, but more than the leanness of the countenance suggested a man who had seen many years and much of the world. The signs were too subtle for her to name, nonetheless real. "Indeed, I thought you wanted an interview for your magazine." His smile was somehow feline. "That isn't exactly what my note asked for, though it did give that impression, didn't it?" Wariness laid hold of her. "What do you want, then? I must confess I'm not familiar with your chart room." "It's not a big publication, nor sensationalistic, may I add. Mostly it runs articles or essays on current events, We often go into history or anthropology, trying to put things in perspective. It sounds interesting. Macandal drew breath. However, I'm afraid I must decline an interview or anything like that. I don't want publicity. It's distasteful to me personally, and it might harm the unity.
Really?
I should think if the work you people are doing, evidently in many ways a unique approach, if it became widely known, you'd get more support, cooperation, everything you need. Others might be inspired to imitate you. I doubt they could successfully. We are unique. One of the things that makes it possible for us to do what we do is precisely our smallness, our intimacy. Being stared at could destroy that. Tannehill's large, half-oblique eyes sought hers and held steady. I suspect it's less important than you yourself, my lady, he said in almost an undertone. And your associate, Miss Dunneau. Alarm stabbed. Macandal drew herself up and raised her voice a bit. What are you after? Will you please come to the point? My apologies. No offense intended. On the contrary. But I do believe we should talk in complete privacy. She came to a decision. Very well. Wait a minute, and I'll issue instructions about that. Stepping into the hall, she found a maid and whispered, The gentleman and I will be in the sanctum. Tell Boyd and Jerry to stand by, and come in at once if I ring. The girl gaped. You expect trouble, ma'am? Not really, Macandal reassured her, but just in case. You didn't keep going immortally by omitting precautions. She returned and led Tannehill in among the things that stood for power. He seemed to scan them thoroughly in the moment that it took her to shut the door. Now do sit down, she told him, more curtly than she had intended. He obeyed. She took a chair across the coffee table. I'd appreciate your explaining your errand as quickly as possible, she said. He couldn't quite hide the tension that was also in him. Forgive me if I don't, he answered. What I'm here about is tremendous. I have to be sure of you before I dare let you in on it. Let me start by promising you there will be no threats, demands, attempts to make you do anything wrong. I belong to an unusual class of people. I have reason to think you and Ms. Dunneau do, too. If so, we'll invite you to join us, for purposes of mutual help and companionship. Can he be? Briefly, the dimness of the chamber hazed before her, and a roaring was in her ears. Through it, she heard, I'll be honest, and hope you won't get angry. I've had a detective agency prepare a report on you two and your organization for me. They did not pry. They simply went around for about a week, chatted with persons who were willing, took a few snapshots, otherwise looked through newspaper files and relevant public records. It was only for purposes of briefing me, so that I could come today prepared to talk intelligently and not waste your time. Tannehill smiled a bit. You, the individual, remain as enigmatic as ever. I know practically nothing about you except that, according to those files and the recollections of two or three aged Unity members, your mother founded this group, which you head, and you resemble her. On the other hand, if I'm not mistaken, I have somewhat more information about Rosa Dunneau. Macandal summoned composure. Her heart wouldn't stop racing, but her mind ran smoothly, and every sense was whetted. If this truly was an immortal, need that be a menace? Be aught but joy? Of course, if he wasn't. Yes, she too must tread with care. Then why haven't you approached her first? She asked. She might not like that. Can't you see? I'm trying not to arouse fears. Tannehill leaned forward, hands on knees. May I tell you a story? Call it a piece of fiction, if you like, or a parable. You're obviously well-read. She nodded. Once upon a time, he began slowly, a woman lived in what is now Istanbul. In those days they called it Constantinople, and it was the capital of a great empire. The woman wasn't born there, but in Syria. She'd had a hard life, knocked around a lot in the world, and taken many cruel knocks from it. Yes, she was much older than she appeared. Not as old as her profession, for which she needed that youthful-looking body. She did well in it, though at intervals she had to pull up stakes and relocate under a different name. To her, at last, came a man who was also older than he seemed. He and his partner had wandered far and wide. At present they were traders on the Russian river route. Always he watched her. She couldn't take it any more. "Stop!" she cried, drawing breath. "Mr. Tannehill, are you by any chance associated with a gentleman named Willock?" The fingers whitened on his knees. "Yes. That is, I know of him. He may not have heard of me. A longevity research foundation engaged him to find people who carry the genes for long life. Extremely long life." "I see." Strange how calm she suddenly was, how detached. It was as if somebody else spoke. "Rosa and I saw his advertisement. We found it interesting." "But you didn't respond." "No. We have to be careful. The Unity works among and against some bad types. We have our enemies, and they have no scruples." "So I've gathered." "I swear to you, Miss Makandal, this group I belong to is decent. In fact, we were alerted to your existence because two among us do human rehabilitation themselves. And we are few." "Oh, very few," he ended. "Nevertheless, you must give me time to consider this. You've learned about us. What do we know about you?" Tannehill sat silent for the better part of a minute before he nodded. "That's reasonable. Ask anything you like." She lifted her brows. "Do you guarantee to answer every single question, truthfully and in full?" He threw back his head and laughed. "No. Good for you." Turning serious. "Not before we fully trust each other. Let me do whatever I can toward that." "For the moment, nothing. I want to run an independent check on you, read a few issues of your magazine, find out how you live, what your neighbors think of you, that sort of thing. What you did to us. It shouldn't take long. Then Rosa and I will plan our next move." He smiled, visibly easing. "What you're telling me is, don't call us, we'll call you." "Okay. On my side, we have both time and patience. We know how to wait. Nothing will happen till you want it to." He reached in a pocket and offered his card to her. "That's my New Hampshire address. My friend and I'm not in town alone, will return there tomorrow. Phone whenever you wish, or write if you prefer. If we go away, I'll tell the staff how to get in touch with me, and should be able to come back here on a day's notice. Thank you." He came near winning her over at once by promptly rising and saying, "No, my thanks to you. I look forward to hearing at your convenience." He paused. "Please tell my fable to Miss Deneau, and add the happy ending. The man in it stopped long ago being angry at the woman. He hopes she'll enjoy meeting him again." "I'll tell her," Makandal agreed. They clasped hands afresh, a touch that clung the least bit, but neither spoke while she saw him to the door. Her gaze followed him till he had disappeared down the mean street, walking briskly and fearlessly. "Well," she thought, "he can take care of himself. He's been in worse places than Harlem by daylight. Damn, what a charmer. Or am I just reading that into him? Aliat may well be right. An immortal man is not necessarily a good man. If he is, though, if they are, she still hasn't explained to me exactly what she's got against him. What am I waiting for? Why am I hanging back? My God, he's a man. There are probably other men. Cool it, girl." The flood of lust receded. It left her a tremble, but able to laugh at herself, and that was a cleansing. Celibacy had been the price she must pay. Mama Lo could not take a series of lovers, and dared not take a husband. She thought, "I was proud of my self-control, and overlooked how self-important I was getting. Down underneath, honey, you're just another raunchy, limited, woundable human being. One who's got responsibilities, though." She went inside again and upstairs to a room that served as a private office. Its prosaic furnishings and equipment brought her further down from dizziness. She had work to do. Makandal settled at the desk and reached for the phone. Among the numbers keyed in were three for certain police officers and one for a middle-rank agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Unity had saved those men when they were children. Restless, they had not stayed. But by then it had equipped them to handle the world, and they remembered. Not that any of them would betray his trust, nor would she ever ask him to. However, more than once they had looked into matters for her, taking for granted that her unspecified reasons were legitimate. Through them she could quickly find out a great deal about Kenneth Tannehill, perhaps even some things he himself didn't know. 11. The cab driver had taken on a grim expression when Aliat gave him the address. He was plainly glad to let her out there and be gone. For a moment she felt forsaken. Twilight lingered in the sky, but the rotting walls around her closed most of it off, and night already possessed the street. What lamp glow fell dully on it showed bare pavement, cracked sidewalks, scraps of paper and plastic, shards of glass, empty cans, cigarette butts, refuse less describable. A few windows, not boarded up, glowered at her. She saw nobody looking from them. It was as if she could smell the fear, one more stench among those that loaded an air still hot. She hastened to the Unity's tenement. The facade was as dingy as the rest. Refurbishing must wait its turn, but she ought to find freshness well advanced within. The workmen had gone home hours ago. Had the neighborhood shown life while they and their cheerful clatter were on hand? The door was locked. It hadn't been on her last visit. She glanced over her shoulder as she leaned on the buzzer and gripped her purse tightly against her ribs. A dark outline appeared in the safety-webbed glass. The man was studying her through a peephole. He took what felt like a long time to let her in. She recognized him, but not the other standing nearby, though each wore the badge of a security volunteer. Well, she could not know every member any more. Neither man was he whom she had expected. "Mrs. Lowe," the first exclaimed, "what are you doing here this late?" "I need to see Randy Castle," she said fast. "I was told he's staying here now."
"Yeah, he is."
A tongue clicked.
"You shouldn't have come, Mrs. Lowe, especially not alone."
"I realized that as soon as I arrived," she kept from admitting. Instead,
"Well, he works all day."
For a hauling company, which kept him on the move, unavailable to her. "I thought he'd be at Hope Flower," the Unity complex where he had an apartment, in a safer district than this. "When he didn't answer my calls, after I'd tried for hours, I rang his parents, and they told me where he was. We need him for a job, and he hasn't any phone here."
"We do."
The guard gestured at the instrument on a table amidst the clutter left by the carpenters.
"I'd have fetched him."
"No, I'm sorry. This is a confidential matter."
"I see."
His trust was instant and absolute.
"Well, he's right down the hall, number 3.
As he pointed, he forced a smile.
"Don't you worry none, Mrs. Lowe. We'll get you home okay."
"One way or t'other," muttered his companion. Beyond the lobby, the corridor had been restored, awaiting only paint and the carpet. She knocked on a new door. The big man flung it open.
"What?"
he growled, and then seeing her,
"Hey, what's going on?"
"I have to talk with you," Aliat said. With awkward, touching deference, he ushered her in and closed the door again. The apartment was neatly finished, but barely furnished, no tenants having been expected yet. Several books rested on a table beside a hot plate, and he had been covering notepaper with scrawled exercises. Like most young folk of the Unity, he was improving his education. His dream was to become an engineer.
"Make yourself to home, Mrs. Lowe,"
tumbled from his lips.
"Glad to see you, but wish you hadn't come, know what I mean? What can I do for you?"
Because he wanted her to, she took the single chair. He offered to make coffee. She shook her head, and he sat down on the floor at her feet. "What's wrong?" she inquired. "Why have you moved? Where's Gus?" the former night watchman. darkness replied,
"Laid up, Mrs. Lowe. Bunch of punks came in four nights ago and beat him pretty bad."
"Has Mama Lowe heard?" she asked, appalled.
"Not yet. We figured might be best to tell you first. Get your opinion."
The disciples trying to protect the saint, Aliat thought, and Corinne might, after all, order abandonment of the project rather than grappling with violence. Men who have learned to be proud don't easily retreat.
"Only you was out of town."
"Yes, this past couple of weeks. I'm sorry, I should have left word where I could be reached. But I never thought there'd be an emergency like this."
"Sure," he said, quite sincerely. "You couldn't have known. You needed a vacation bad, you did. We noticed how tired you was getting."
Not really, she thought. At least not in the flesh. Still, it's true, administration and treasury and accounting and counseling and everything I do for us, mostly by myself because we can't afford a proper staff, it does wear me down. No matter how much the unity means to me, I cannot make it my whole life. I don't have the spirit, the goodness, for that. From time to time I've got to get away, take what I've saved out of my little paychecks, and go elsewhere under a different name, enjoy a bit of luxury, glamour, fun, have an affair if I meet somebody attractive.
And mostly these past several years that's been a man, not a woman. The unity has washed away a lot of bitterness and started many sores healing.
Why am I talking to myself like this? To push away guilt that I was absent?
How is Gus? He'll be all right. Healer Jules fixed him up neat as any regular doctor could have, and they're taking care of him at his place.
You didn't notify the police then?
What use? Just put ourselves to a lot of trouble.
Listen, Aliat rapped. How often must Mama Lowe and I explain the police are not our enemies? The criminals are.
I'm only half a hypocrite, she thought. Mostly, I guess, the cops mean well, but they're saddled with laws that breed crime worse than Prohibition ever did.
Well, if nothing else, they're stretched too thin, Castle said defensively. They can't post a round-the-clock watch for us, can they? And Gus told us those scumbags promised worse if we don't clear out. Maybe firebombing, even. We decided we'd strengthen nighttime security. That ought to discourage him. That's why me and some other men are staying here.
Chill crept along Aliat's backbone. The street outside was bare and quiet. So quiet. Had word gone around that something was in the works? What could she do? Nothing, unless later.
Do be careful, she begged. None of this is worth losing a single life.
You might have 50 or 60 years left you, Randy, dear.
You too, Mrs. Lowe. Don't you risk coming here again after dark, not till we got the quarter cleaned up.
He sat straight, quickly eager.
What do you want? How can we help you?
That wakened the thrill that had coursed through when she spoke with Corinne upon her return today. It flamed the sordid surroundings out of her. She couldn't sit still. She sprang to her feet.
I have to take a long drive up into New Hampshire. I'll be needing a driver and, let's hope not, but maybe a bodyguard. Someone strong and completely reliable, including able to keep his mouth shut. I thought right away of you. Are you willing?
He likewise had risen to loom above her and exult.
At your service, Mrs. Lowe, and thank you.
You probably needn't lose time from work. Now that I know I can count on you, I'll write ahead and tell them to expect me.
She didn't really think mail would be intercepted, but she'd use a private express service to be safe and to make sure of overnight delivery. Tannehill could reply in the same fashion.
We'll leave early Saturday morning. If everything goes well, we can return Sunday evening, or I might stay a while and you come back alone.
If I decide I dare trust them there...
Sure.
He grew troubled.
You mentioned a bodyguard. Could it turn dangerous? I wouldn't feel right about taking you into danger.
No, I don't expect any physical threats. Is that absolutely true? She wondered. With a grin.
It might help my errand if you're in the background being huge. My purpose will be to convey a message and then, I think, confer.
The message being that Corinne has learned Kenneth Tannehill is under close surveillance, apparently on behalf of a United States senator. She had just about decided to mail him the warning when I arrived.
I told her that if I deliver it in person, that ought to rock him back enough that I can grab the initiative and what? Take his measure. Cadog, Hanno. It can only be him whom I robbed and tried to get killed. He told her he's forgiven me, and 900 years would be a long time to carry a grudge unless it's festered that whole while. We've got to decide whether to join with him and whoever else is in his band, and how to join, on what terms, if we do. I think I can recognize a crook or a monster sooner, more certainly, than Mama Lo. This will be kind of peculiar, though, Randy, she said. I need to enter the place and leave it unbeknownst to, well, whoever might be watching from outside. I'll figure out some sort of disguise, maybe cut my hair short, make my face up dark, dress like a man, and we carry toolkits to seem like workers sent to do some repair job. The car wheel drive is old and plain, and I'll get hold of New Hampshire plates. Though the Unity shunned crime, you were bound to learn who in town could supply what for a price. We'll switch along the way. An excitement she had well nigh forgotten over road forebodings. Shoot the dice into hell with the authorities. Am I still an outlaw at heart? But here stands this boy. I'm sorry, she finished. We can't let you sit in on our talks, and I can't tell you anything. All I can do is swear this is honest business. I wouldn't doubt that for one second, Mrs. Lowe, he answered. Her fingers closed on the brown hand before her. You are a darling. Through the door went a crash and a scream. Hoy, them? Castle plunged across the room. Racket resounded. Stay put, Mrs. Lowe, he yelled. From a carton on the floor, he pulled an object darkly metallic and sped for the door. I'm coming, brothers. Hang on. No, wait, drop that thing. Don't, Randy. Aliat had no time to think. She followed the man who grasped the pistol that was forbidden to common folk. Down the hall, beyond the lobby, Aliat saw safety glass shattered. Smoke eddied against the night. Half a dozen men, youths, creatures were in. The guards, two invaders, held one watchman hard against the wall. Where was his companion? Others of the Unity boiled forth at Aliat's back. Halt, you bastards! Castle roared. His gun barked, a warning shot aloft. An attacker responded straight. Castle lurched, reeled back, somehow fired levelly before he fell. Aliat glimpsed the blood that spouted from his throat. The hammer smote her. 12. Moriarty was at breakfast when Stoddard called. The senator kept a phone in that room, too. Even in this his summer home, in his own secure state, he must always be ready, and the number was unlisted, which gave some protection. The voice immediately yanked his full awareness to it. Once he whistled, once he breathed, my God. He finally snapped, up the first plane you can get out of National. Take a cab at this end. Never mind what that costs. Bring all the material you have to date. I need the background. Been on the trail, you know, hitting the hustings. Okay. It does sound good, doesn't it? Hurry. Bye. He hung up. What was that about? Asked his wife. Sorry, top secret, he replied. Will you see to rescheduling my appointments today? Including the garrison's party? Remember who'll be there. Sorry. This is that important. You go, offer my regrets, and charm the socks off the VIPs. I'll do my best. Which is mighty fine, my love. What a first lady she'd make someday. Someday, when his destiny blossomed. She wouldn't mind the other women much then. Excuse me if I eat and run. I've got a lot to clear away in less time than I was counting on. He did, in truth. Congress had adjourned, but constituents never set their problems aside, and he couldn't defend the key interests. And the convention had left him with several cans of worms to get rid of before the election. And, meanwhile, his speech, day after tomorrow, needed more work. It was merely at the dedication of a high school, but if he said the right things in striking new phrases, the media might pick one up. He must find an identifying motto, like FDR's, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, or JFK's, ask not what your country. He received Stoddard a few hours later in his study. It was an airy room with a view over salt water that danced and glittered and upbore white wings of sailboats.
Autographed photos of himself and the company of famous persons did not cover the walls as they did those of his Washington office. Instead, there were a few family portraits, a landscape painted by his daughter, a horsemanship trophy from prep school days, a case of books for reference and recreation rather than display. He looked up from the desk, greeted, "Hello, sit down," realized how brusque he had been. "Excuse me, I guess I'm more on edge than I knew." Stoddard took a swivel chair, leaned back, laid his briefcase across his lap. "Me too, Senator. Mind if I smoke?" "No." Moriarty sketched a rueful smile. "Wish I dared. We're alone." Stoddard held the pack toward him. Moriarty shook his head. "No, thanks. Quitting was too hard. I wonder what Churchill would have made of a society where you can't take a puff any longer if you hope for national office, unless you're from a tobacco state." A match gritted. "Otherwise, yes. What one does is vote price support, subsidies, and export assistance for the tobacco industry while calling for a war on dangerous addictive drugs." Damn the son of a bitch. Too bad he was so useful. Well, that jape had cost him the offer of a drink. "Let's get cracking. How much detail do you have on this affair?" "How much do you, sir?" "I read the piece in the Times after you called. It wasn't very informative." "No, I suppose not, because on the surface it isn't much of a story. Another little shootout among the socially deprived of New York City." Glee exploded. "But it has a connection to Tannehill." "Maybe," Stoddard cautioned. "All we're sure of is that members of the Unity were involved, and Tannehill visited its head last month, and it's a rather strange outfit. Not underground, but reclusive? We'd have to spend quite a while digging for information, and it might well prove to be a wild goose chase. Tannehill could have seen the head woman for some completely unrelated reason, like wanting to write an article. He was definitely at home during the incident. Still is, last I heard." Moriarty quelled the interior seething. "Is this actually ridiculous?" he wondered. "Why am I turning the heavy artillery on a gadfly?" "Because an instinct that my calling has honed tells me there is something big behind this. Big, big. Uncovering it could do more than silence a noisy reactionary. It could lift me into orbit. 4 years hence, 8 at most, I could be bringing that new dawn which Tannehill and his night spooks dread." He sat back into well-worn, accepting, creaky leather, and set a part of his mind to telling one muscle after the next that it should slack off. "Look," he said, "you know I haven't had time to stay abreast of your efforts. Brief me. Begin at the beginning. Never mind if you repeat this or that I've heard before. I want the facts arranged orderly for inspection." "Yes, sir." Stoddard opened the case and took out a manila folder. "Suppose I give you a quick summary from the start before we go into particulars." "Fine." Stoddard checked his notes. "I did tell you when Tannehill reappeared in New Hampshire, you remember. We've had a tail on him since then. As per your instructions, I notified the FBI of that. The agent I talked to was a little annoyed." "He considered me officious, no doubt." Moriarty laughed. "Better that than seem furtive. And it has planted a bee in their bonnet. Go on." "Shortly after his return..." "Do you want dates? Not yet?" "Shortly afterward, Tannehill went down to New York, took a hotel room, and met a plane from Copenhagen at Kennedy Airport. A young woman, flew to his arms when she'd cleared customs, and they were shacked up in that hotel for several days. It looked like a honeymoon situation, sightseeing, fancy restaurants, you know the bit. We checked back, of course. Her name is Olga Rasmussen, Danish citizen, but actually from Russia, a refugee. Some puzzling things about her, but it's hard to do detail work internationally, and expensive. You decide whether we should." Meanwhile, Tannehill dropped in at Unity headquarters. He didn't stay long and hasn't been in touch again, unless he's got a secret line. Stoddard said nothing about the legality of any wiretaps, and Moriarty didn't inquire. He and Rasmussen went north to his place. They've been there since, not going out much, nor doing anything unusual in public. Except lately they drove to the nearest airport and brought home a man who's now their house guest or whatever.
We haven't been able to trace him, apart from indications that he's from the West Coast. Native American, to judge by his appearance.
What sort?
Moriarty asked.
They don't all look alike.
Huh?
Well, he's tall and hawk-faced.
Tannehill introduced him to shopkeepers and such in the village as John Wanderer.
West Coast.
Well, what about the violence last night?
Apparently the local drug baron in that section of New York had his goons make a raid on a tenement that Unity is fixing for its members. He seems to have been trying to force it up before it gets established on his turf. It's too apt to choke off businesses like his.
Moriarty searched his memory.
I may have heard a little about Unity before the story today, but I'm not sure. Tell me.
They're obscure, Stoddard said.
I gather that's by choice. Stay compact, controllable. Keep a low profile. It's a kind of self-help organization in the poverty classes, but not like any other. Not a church, though it has a religious element. Ceremonies, anyhow. Not a militant group, though the members stick together, including on patrols that are more than simple neighborhood watches. However, hitherto they've avoided breaking any laws where anybody could see. The president, high priestess, whatever her title is, she's quite the mystery woman. Black, name of Corinne Macandal. She has a white associate, Rosa Deneau, who's the one involved in the shooting. And that's about all we've turned up so far on Unity.
Tell me about the affair, Moriarty urged. The account in the paper was so sketchy.
I'm afraid mine will be, too. Deneau was at this restoration project when the gang broke in. One of the Unity men had a firearm. Shots were exchanged. He was killed, but not before he'd done for an enemy. Deneau was seriously wounded.
Moriarty nodded.
Saturday night specials, bullets sprang around, and nevertheless the rednecks quack about the Second Amendment.
Continue.
Any more casualties? Two unarmed night watchmen had been roughed up. Several other men from Unity were staying at the place, but they had only clubs. Well, a couple of permissible-type knives.
Bad enough.
None of them were hurt?
No, nor engaged.
After those few shots, the attackers fled. Obviously, they hadn't expected that kind of resistance. My guess is that they intended vandalism, destruction. The Unity people called the police. The dead men went to the morgue, Deneau to the hospital. Shot through the chest. Condition serious but stable.
Moriarty tugged his chin and squinted out across the sunlit waters.
I dare say the head honcho, Macandal, is that her name? She'll issue a statement expressing shock and disavowing those vigilantes. My impression is they'll swear it was strictly their own idea,
which might be true.
Deneau should know more if she survives, a material witness at the very least. Yes, I think this was not simply another brawl in the slums.
Triumph trumpeted.
I believe we can find grounds for me to demand a federal investigation of Unity and everybody who's ever touched it.
13.
Actually, by and large, Indian men worked as hard as their women, Wanderer said. It was just that the division of labor was sharper than among whites, and the women's share was what a visitor in camp saw.
But wasn't the men's part more fun? Svoboda asked. Hunting, for instance? Her expression was rapt. Here she sat in the presence of a man who had been of those fabulous tribes, had experienced the Wild West.
Hanno considered lighting his pipe. Better not. Svoboda disliked it, and he'd cut back on that account. Probably soon she'd make him quit altogether. Meanwhile, he thought grumpily, why doesn't she aim a few of her questions my way? I saw a bit of the American frontier, too. I knew this land we're on when it was wilderness.
His gaze went out the nearer window of the living room. Afternoon sunlight glowed across the lawn. At the edge of grass, a flower bed flaunted red, violet, gold below the burglar alarm chain-link fence that surrounded the property. From here, he couldn't see the driveway sweep in from the county road, through an electrically controlled gate, and between stately beech trees to the mansion. Visible instead behind the fence were second-growth woods whose leafage billowed and twinkled under the wind. A lovely place, this, the ideal retreat after New York.
peacefulness in which he and Svoboda could explore each other more deeply, and she could get to know Wanderer. But he must return to Seattle and affairs neglected. She'd come along. She'd enjoy the city and adore its hinterland. Wanderer ought to stay behind a while in case of a message from Makandal. Would those two women ever stop dithering, or whatever they were at? Svoboda was anxious to meet Asagao and Dushan. He, Hanno, should not think in terms of distracting her from Wanderer. He didn't own her. He had no right to be jealous, and anyway there was nothing serious between those two, so far. The phone rang. Wanderer stopped in mid-sentence. "Go on," Hanno invited. "It may not need any response." The answering machine recited its instructions aloud and beeped. A female voice came, rapid, not quite steady. "Madame Aliat must speak with Mr. Tannehill. It's urgent. Don't call straight back." "Aliat." Hanno was already across the room. He snatched the receiver from the antique table. "Hello? Tannehill here. Is that you?" No. He recognized Makandal's tones. "Parlez-vous français?" "What?" His mind leaped. "Oui." He had maintained his French in serviceable, if less than perfect, condition, updating as the language evolved, for it was often a valuable tool. "Désirez-vous parler comme ci? Pourquoi, s'il vous plaît?" She had had less practice in recent decades, talked slowly and haltingly, sometimes required his help in making clear what she meant. Fallen silent, Wanderer and Svoboda heard his speech grow steely, saw his visage stiffen. "Bien. Bonne chance. Au revoir. Espérons-nous." He put the receiver back and turned to his companions. For a moment only, the wind outside gave utterance. Then he said, "First, I'll make sure nobody overhears," and went out. The household staff didn't eavesdrop, nor interrupt unless necessary, but English was the sole common tongue today. Returning, he stood arms akimbo before the chairs they swung around, and stated into their stares, "That was Corinne Makandal, finally, and not with glad tidings. I wish now I had the New York Times delivered here." Harshly, he told them about the disaster of night before last. "Oh, terrible!" Svoboda got up, reaching for him. He didn't notice. Wanderer stayed where he was, lynx alert. "I've worse yet," Hanno said. "Makandal has friends in certain government departments, especially police." He recognized the unspoken question on the woman's lips and threw her a wintry grin. "No, you can't call them moles. They give her information, or early warning, at her request, which is seldom. Nothing for bad purposes, merely so she won't be caught off base. The sort of precaution an immortal would naturally take. I used to myself till I got into a position where it was better to steer as clear of government as possible. Well, after I'd seen her, she wanted to know about me before committing herself to any course of action or inaction, no more than I might be willing to reveal. So she inquired of those contacts and discovered that I've been under detective surveillance since shortly before our meeting. It's at the behest of Edmund J. Moriarty. Yes, Nettie the senator, my bête noire. Apparently I've become his." He sighed. "I should have left him alone. I thought I was doing a public service badgering him, that I owed the United States this slight help because I honestly doubt it could survive his presidency. My mistake. I should have concentrated on our own survival." Too late. Svoboda had whitened. "The secret police?" she whispered. "No, no." Hanno patted her shoulder. "You should know better after your years in the West, or have you been listening to European leftists? The Republic hasn't decayed that far yet. I dare say Moriarty has been fishing in hopes he'll find something to discredit or incriminate Kenneth Tannehill. Makandal doesn't see it that way. I gather she admires him because he's supposedly done things for the poor. She's been too busy to learn much history. The revelation that he was after me caused her to hang back from further contact. Might I actually be evil? She does have a hell of a lot to lose, not money, but a whole life work." "Never mind," Wanderer said. "Plain to see in this crisis she felt she had to tip you off regardless." "It's more than that," Hanno replied. "We talked very circumspectly. A lot of what I tell you, I deduce logically from her indirect words on the basis of what I knew before. But she checked again with her Washington sources and found she's now under the eye, too. After that gunfight, Moriarty may very well succeed in getting the FBI on the case. That's the Federal Bureau of Investigations, Svoboda, a sort of national police. The drug connection, if nothing else. Even though Unity's fought the narcotics traffic more effectively than any branch of government, well, could Tannehill be in it? Could he have masterminded that assault? Also, the unfortunate fact is that the member who was killed had a pistol and used it. In New York, that's more illegal than mugging a grandmother. Since the Getz case, the liberals have been out for blood. The Kandal should be able to prove her innocence, but she'll have a devil of a time first, and anything might come out in the course of the investigation. Not to mention that other woman, Aliat, being in the hospital. Yeah, she hasn't been interrogated in her condition, but when they do go to work on her, the fat could be in the fire. During her whorehouse days, she was repeatedly arrested. You know the drill, spasm of public morality. Hustle the girls off to show your zeal for law enforcement, then let them right back out. She was fingerprinted over and over through the years, and the FBI has accumulated the world's largest collection of fingerprints. Wanderer grunted as if hit in the belly. Svoboda caught her lip between her teeth. Well, Makandal had already decided she should stop hesitating. Get in touch with me. Try to find out for herself what kind of a guy I am, Hanno continued. Aliat was to come this weekend as her representative and, scout. An acid test, considering what last happened between us two. First, they had in mind an express message to set up the meeting, me to reply the same way. But the shooting cut that off. Now she saw she'd better put her suspicions aside and confer in earnest. An exchange of written communications would obviously be too slow and cumbersome. A personal visit would give away too much, and we can't manage a clandestine one in a hurry. Our phones are quite likely tapped, under the new circumstances. A word from Moriarty would persuade a judge of the proper political faith to allow that, but still seemed the only way. As soon as the police and the press withdrew, she left her house and called me from a member's place. Chances are nobody listening in knows French. It should take a little time to get a recording translated, and we used every possible circumlocution. I don't think we let slip any hard and fast evidence that she was the person on the line. Still, she has undoubtedly compromised herself to a greater or lesser degree. It was a brave thing to do, but also necessary, Svoboda said. Our secret is in the worst danger it ever has been, no? Mainly she wanted to give me and any other immortals I know an opportunity to get out from under, make ourselves invisible if we want to. Hanno lifted a clenched fist. By God, she has a free heart. I wish I could be as sure about her head. At the moment, she's for ending the masquerade, making a clean breast of everything. Does she trust the government that much? Svoboda wondered. It wouldn't be dangerous for her, I should think, Wanderer said thoughtfully. Not at first, anyhow. Hard on us, maybe. Especially you, Hanno. The Phoenician laughed. I'd go hoarse listing my crimes aloud. Just for openers, all those false identities of mine, complete with Social Security dog tags and annual tax returns, not to mention assorted licenses, birth and death certificates, passports. Oh, I've been a desperate character, I have. You might be let off easy, even pardoned, Wanderer said. And the rest of us for our petty offenses. We'd be such a sensation. He grimaced. At worst, some years in jail wouldn't matter too greatly to us. His tone belied the words. It recalled roofless heavens and boundless horizons. No, it would be hellishly dangerous, Hanno declared. It might well become lethal for us and a lot of bystanders. I couldn't explain why over the phone, what with the haste and the probable listeners and her poor French, but I did convince Makandal we must consider the possible consequences before we let our cat out of the bag, that a snap judgment would be completely irresponsible. Wanderer's voice went dry. From what you've told me about her, that was an argument she found hard to resist. She knows from Aliat I've been around a long time. tentatively, she'll credit me with more knowledge of the world than she has. She'll disappear and lie low till we can better assess the situation. How is she going to pull that off? Oh, it is easy if she has an organization loyal to her, Svoboda said. I can imagine any number of ruses. For example, let a woman who resembles her come to the house. Inside, they exchange clothes and Makandal walks out. After dark, that should work. Her people will hide her until she can reach a refuge she surely prepared beforehand. How shall we and she get in touch later if we don't know each other's locations or aliases? Wanderer asked. She must have told her comrade Aliat what the possibilities are. How can Aliat tell us? In fact, why are we wasting air on this chatter when she's a prisoner and the cops will shortly have the clues to her nature? Didn't Makandal point that out to you, Hanno? No, the other man said. It hadn't occurred to her. She was shocked, bewildered, harassed, grieved, exhausted. I'm amazed she could think straight at all. Since I wanted her to make her exit, I refrained from bringing the question up. Besides, the Aliat matter is not entirely hopeless.
Chitor?
Svoboda cried. What do you mean? The truth won't come out overnight, Hanno reminded them. Possibly it never would. I'm not certain that copies of prints from those obscure police files of decades ago ever got to Washington. If they did, or if the investigators get the idea of making a search, that'll take time. And then, if an identity is found, well, Thomas Jefferson, who was as enlightened a man as ever lived, once said he could more readily believe that some Yankee professors had lied than that stones fell from the sky. It would be scientifically more respectable to assume there'd been a mix-up in the records than that a human being could stay young for 50 or 100 years. Svoboda scowled. Possession of her would not allow that assumption, I think, and she might decide that telling everything will be to her profit. She might very well, Hanno agreed, remembering. Oh, 1,000 things could go wrong from our viewpoint. Let's see if we can't take corrective action. For that purpose, and for more obvious reasons, we'll decamp tonight. The gate is watched, you tell me, Svoboda said glumly. How, I do not know. I have not noticed a parked car or men standing on that rural road. Why should you? A battery-powered miniature TV camera in the brush opposite will serve. The road dead-ends at the lake, you may recall. Bound anywhere else, you head in the opposite direction and pass the Willows Lodge. No doubt 2 or 3 persons checked in a little while ago and spend more time in their cabin than is usual for vacationers. You can glorify modern technology as much as you want, Wanderer growled. Me, more and more I feel the walls closing in. How shall we evade them? Svoboda asked. Dread and despair had yielded to keenness. Hanno grinned. Every fox has 2 holes to his burrow. Let's pack what we'll need. I keep plenty of cash on hand, together with traveler's checks, credit cards, assorted ID not made out to Tannehill. I'll hand the servants a plausible story, which'll contain a red herring. Tonight. A panel at the rear of the fence swings aside without touching off the alarm, if you know what to do. It gives on the woods, and the village is 3 miles beyond that. There's a man there, lives alone, grumpy old bachelor type, who likes my magazine except he complains it's too leftish. I always try to cultivate somebody whenever I maintain a base for any span of time. Somebody I can rely on to do me an occasional favor and not mention it to anyone else. He'll drive us to where we can get a bus or train. We'll probably be smart to switch conveyances en route, but we'll still be in New York tomorrow. 14. The hospital building might well be 100 years old, brick dark with grime, windows not lately washed. The modernization inside was minimal. This was for the poor, the indigent, the victims of accident and violence. Its neighbors were as drab. The traffic that rumbled and screeched about them was mostly commercial and industrial. The air was foul with its fumes. A taxi drew up at the curb. Hanno passed the driver a $20 bill. Wait here, he directed. We're fetching a friend. She'll be pretty weak. Needs to get home right away. I'll have to circle the block if you take too long, the driver warned. Circle it fast, then, and park again whenever you see a chance. This is worth a nice tip.
The driver looked dubious, understandable considering the institution. Svoboda ostentatiously jotted down his name and number. Hanno followed her out and closed the door. He carried a parcel, she an overnight bag. "Remember now, this will only work if we behave as though we own the accounts receivable office," he muttered. "You remember I have been a sharpshooter and slipped through the iron curtain," she answered haughtily. "Oh, sorry, that was a stupid thing for me to say. I'm distracted. Ah, there he is." Hanno inclined his head in the direction of Wanderer. Shabbily clad, hat pulled low, the Indian slouched along the sidewalk like one with nothing better to do. Hanno and Svoboda entered a gloomy lobby. A uniformed guard cast them an incurious glance. Even these patients sometimes got visitors. Reconnoitering yesterday, they had ascertained that no police guard was on Rosa Deneau. She had automatically been taken here, and it was deemed unsafe to transfer her to a better hospital when the word came that money was available to pay for that. Therefore, this place's security ought to suffice. Hanno sought a men's room. It was unoccupied, but he entered a stall to be cautious. Opening his parcel, he unfolded a smock coat and donned it. He'd acquired it, plus a lot of other stuff, at a medical supply firm. It wasn't quite identical with what the orderlies wore, but should get by if nobody had cause to look closely. Outfits faded or stained were more the rule than the exception. He dropped the wrapping in a trash can and rejoined Svoboda. They took an elevator upward. They had learned yesterday that Rosa Deneau was on the 7th floor. The receptionist had told them she could only have very brief visits, and remarked on how many people came, anxiously inquiring. Two women had been on hand when Hanno and Svoboda walked into the ward. They had brought flowers, which they could probably ill afford. Hanno smiled at them, went to the bedside, bent over the victim. She lay white, hollow-cheeked, shallowly breathing. He would not have recognized her had he not seen the pictures his detectives took for him. Indeed, without the hunch that this was she, he might well never have known her by those snapshots. It had been a long, long time. He hoped that her Romaic Greek was no rustier than his. After all, he supposed, she'd mostly been in the Levant before coming to America. "Aliat, my friend and I believe we can smuggle you out. Do you want that? Otherwise, you'll lose your liberty forever, you know. I have money. I can give you the freedom of the world. Do you want to escape?" She lay mute for a moment that stretched before she barely nodded. "Well, do you think you can walk a short distance and make it look natural? 100 meters, perhaps. We'll help you. But if you fall, we'll have to leave you and flee." A ghost of color tinged her skin. "Yes," she whispered, unthinkingly in English. "Tomorrow afternoon, then, make sure you have no callers. Tell these people you feel worse and need a few days undisturbed. Ask them to spread the word. Husband your strength." He straightened to meet the stares of the women from Unity. "I wasn't aware she's in this serious a condition," he told them. "Otherwise I'd have let her know beforehand my wife and I were coming." "You from out of town?" asked one. "Yes, we haven't seen her for quite a while, but we read about the, incident, and since we're of her nationality and had business in New York anyway." "Well, I am sorry. We'd better go, Olga. We'll see you later, Rosa, when you're more recovered. Take care." The Svoboda patted the limp hands. They left. A walk around the 7th-floor halls, a quick peek into the ward as they went by, revealed no sign of a trap. If Aliat didn't actually wish to leave, with the hazards and pains that meant, she could help herself by spilling the truth and ratting on Hanno. He had gambled on her distrust of authority being too ingrained after her many centuries, or at least on her having the shrewdness to foresee that confession would close out every other choice. This entire operation was a gamble. If it failed, and he and Svoboda could not make a getaway, he mustn't let worry dull his wits and sap his energy. "Damn," he said. "No wheelchair. Let's try the next floor down." They got lucky there. Wheelchairs, gurneys, and the like commonly stood unattended in the corridors. He took what he wanted and pushed it briskly to the elevator. A nurse glanced at him, parted her lips,
half shrugged and hurried onward. The staff was overworked, underpaid, and doubtless had considerable turnover on that account. Svoboda trailed him at a discreet distance, pretending to look for a room number. Back on 7, they proceeded to Aliot's ward. Speed was now the key to everything. Svoboda entered first. If a nurse or doctor was present, they'd have to continue prowling around, biding their chance. She stepped back to the doorway and beckoned. His heart bumped. He went in past her. The dingy room held a double row of beds, most occupied. Some patients watched the televisions above either row. Some dozed. Some were vegetables. A few looked at the newcomer, but dully. None questioned him. Hanno hadn't expected they would. An environment like this was ghastly, deadening. Aliat, too, had fallen asleep. She blinked her eyes open when he touched her shoulder. Abruptly, he did know her again, the ferret alertness that she had dissembled until too late for him last time around. He beamed. "All right, Miss Deneau, let's go for those lab tests, shall we?" he said. She nodded and visibly braced herself. Oh, she knew this would hurt. He kept old sailor skills, such as carrying loads carefully, and while his body wasn't that of any Hercules, its wiriness had never flagged. He bent his knees, took hold, swung her from bed to chair. Her arms crept about his neck. He felt a brief, roguish flirt of fingers in his hair. He also heard the sharply indrawn breath. Svoboda had kept aside and continued to do so while he wheeled Aliot to the elevator. She took it together with them. Yesterday, he and she had found what they wanted on the second floor, minimizing the distance Aliot must go on her feet. It was another gamble that the hydrotherapy bath would be vacant, but a fairly safe bet at this time of day. Hanno took Aliot in, told her in a few words what came next, and left. Somebody else was walking by. Hanno went the opposite way, his expression preoccupied. Svoboda dawdled until she could slip in unobserved, carrying her overnight bag. Again Hanno took shelter in a men's room, and spent an agreed-on 10 minutes by his watch, seated on a toilet and contemplating graffiti. They were uniformly vulgar and semi-literate. "I should raise the tone of this joint," he decided. "Anything to keep from fretting." He unclipped a pen, located a clear space, and printed carefully. X to the n power plus y to the n power equals z to the n power has no integral solution for all n greater than 2. I have found a marvelous proof of this theorem, but there is not room in this stall to write it down. Time. He left his smock behind and returned to the bath. Svoboda was just emerging. Splendid girl. Aliot leaned on her, no longer in a hospital gown, but a dress, stockings, shoes, a lightweight coat that covered the bulges of bandages. Svoboda had kept the bag. Hanno joined them and lent his support. "How are you doing?" he asked in English. Air and blood rattled. "I'll make it," Aliot gasped, but, oh, shit, no, never mind. Her weight pulled at him. She minced along unevenly, now and then staggering. Sweat studded her face and reeked in his nostrils. He had seen corpses less blue-pale. Nevertheless, she moved, and it was as though she gained a bit of strength thereby, until you could almost say she walked. "That's the wild card in my hand," Hanno thought. "The vitality of the immortal. No normal human could do this so soon after such a wounding. But she won't be able to either unless she draws on whatever wellsprings are her own." In the downbound elevator she sagged. Hanno and Svoboda upheld her. "You must be firm and walk straight," the Ukrainian said. "It is only for a little way. Then you can rest. Then you will be free." Aliot peeled lips back from teeth. "There's a dance in the old dame yet." When they emerged in the lobby, she didn't exactly stride, but you'd have to look hard to notice how much help she needed. Hanno's eyes flickered back and forth. Where the hell? Yes, yonder sat the Indian, on the split and peeling plastic of a settee, thumbing through a decrepit magazine. Wanderer saw them, lurched to his feet, reeled against a man passing by. "Hey," he shouted, "why don't you look where you're going?" With an obscenity added for good measure. There's the front door, Hanno murmured in Aliot's ear. Up, two, three, four. Wanderer's altercation loudened on his right. It caught everybody's attention. A couple of guards pushed toward him. Hanno hoped he wouldn't overdo it. The idea was to provide 2 or 3 minutes' distraction without getting arrested, merely expelled. Trouble with Wanderer, he's a gentleman by instinct. He doesn't have the talent for acting a belligerent drunk. He does have brains, however, and tact. Into the open. Dusty though it was, sunlight momentarily dazzled. The taxi stood at the curb. Hermes, god of travelers, merchants, and thieves. Thanks. Hanno helped Aliot in. She slumped bonelessly and struggled for breath. Svoboda took her other side. Hanno gave an address. The cab started off. As it wove its way through congestion and squawks, Aliot's weight swayed to and fro. Svoboda felt beneath her coat, nodded, pinch-lipped, took a towel from the bag and held it in place, more or less concealed. To blot up blood, Hanno knew. The injury was hemorrhaging.
"Say that lady all right?" the driver asked. "Looks to me like they shouldn't have let her go." "Schatz-Metterklume syndrome," Hanno explained. "She does need to get home and to bed as fast as you can make it."
"Yeah," Aliot rasped. "Come on and see me tomorrow, big boy."
The driver widened his mouth and rolled his eyes, but pushed on. At the destination, Hanno redeemed his promise of a lavish tip. It should buy silence. Did pursuit guess that a taxi had been involved? Not that the story would help the police much by that time. "Around the corner," Svoboda told Aliot. "Half a block." Red dripped onto the sidewalk. Nobody else seemed to notice, or if they did, they chose not to get involved. Hanno had counted on that. A small moving van stood in a parking garage. Hanno had rented it yesterday, contracting to turn it in at Pocatello, Idaho. Its bulk screened from casual glances how her companions lifted Aliot into the body of it. A foam mattress and bedding waited, together with what medical supplies one could readily buy. Hanno and Svoboda peeled her clothes off. They washed her, applied an antibiotic, dressed the wound anew, made her as comfortable as they could. "I think she will recover," Svoboda said.
"Damn straight I will," Aliot mumbled.
"Leave us," Svoboda ordered Hanno. "I will care for her." The Phoenician obeyed. She'd been a soldier who knew first aid. She'd been a veterinarian, and humans aren't vastly unlike their kindred. He closed the tail doors on them and settled himself to wait in the cab. At least he could indulge in a pipe of tobacco now, and a slight case of the shakes. Before long, Wanderer arrived. Hanno had rarely seen him this joyful.
"Whoopee-tie-i-o," he warbled. "Maybe I better take the first stretch at the wheel," Hanno said.
The van growled to life. He paid the parking fee and set forth westward. 15. It was natural that Mr. and Mrs. Dew would arrange a picnic for their guests, the people they'd met in the cities, but the kids were disappointed that they weren't invited, too. These seemed like real interesting folks, in spite of not saying much about themselves. First was convalescent Miss Adler, whom the Dews met in Pocatello and drove here. She was mending so fast that her trouble couldn't have been too bad. The rest had to stay at the hotel in town, but spent their days on the ranch. Mr. and Mrs. Tazurin, Mr. Langford, who admitted he was an Indian, and Black Miss Edmonds, all different from each other and from everybody else. Well, probably they wanted to be alone and talk about plans, like maybe for enlarging the house, making room for more fosterlings. They did act pretty solemn, nice enough, but not like vacationers. Mostly they included the Dews, strolled off by twos and threes, gone for hours. On the brow of a hill that commanded a wide and beautiful view, Dushan had long since assembled a redwood table and benches. The party parked their cars nearby and got out. For a while they stood silent, looking. Halfway up the eastern sky, the sun made a few clouds as brilliant as the western snow peaks. Between stretched 1,000 greens, range, cropland, trees along the lazily shining river. A pair of hawks wheeled aloft, their wings edged with gold. A breeze mildened the air. It murmured and smelled of ripeness.
Let's talk before we unload the eats,
Hanno proposed. That was unnecessary, having been understood, but it got things started. Humans were apt to put off making difficult decisions, and immortals especially so.
I hope we can finish in time to relax and enjoy ourselves, but if need be, we'll wrangle till sundown. That's the deadline, agreed?
He sat down. Svoboda joined him on his right, Wanderer on the left. Opposite them were benched Dushan, Asagao, Aliat, and she whose name among them remained Corinne Makandal. Yes, Hanno thought. In spite of having tried to get well acquainted and become a fellowship, we still unnoticingly divide up according to the partnerships we had. None would have accepted a chairman, but one person had to take the initiative, and he was the senior.
Let me summarize the agenda, he said. I can't tell you anything new or unobvious. However, maybe I can save us further repetition. The basic question is, shall we surrender to the government and reveal to the world what we are, or shall we continue our masquerade using new masks? On the surface, there's no great hue and cry out for us. Rosa Deneau was spirited from the hospital. Corinne Makandal dropped from sight. Likewise did Kenneth Tannehill and a couple of house guests. But that was elsewhere, and he often goes out of town, is away much more than he is at home. No sensation in the news, not even Rosa's disappearance. She's obscure. Few people really care about the patients in that hospital. Nobody has claimed she was kidnapped or otherwise met foul play. And in fact, none of the persons I've named are charged with anything. I thought that must be too good to be true, and Corinne informs me it is. She's queried her connections, twice, was it, from her hiding places. Ned Moriarty is still very interested. The FBI thinks the matter is worth looking into. Could possibly involve drugs or espionage or antics less spectacular but just as unlawful. Have you any later information, Corinne?
Makandal shook her head. No, she replied quietly, nor will I. Already I've put more strain on the honor of those men than I should have. I won't call them again.
I've pipelines of my own from Seattle, Hanno said, but using them gets dicier for every day that passes. Tannehill is associated with Tomek Enterprises. The FBI will at least be inquiring into that. They may decide there's nothing to it, that Tomek's friends have no idea why Tannehill vamoosed. However, they certainly will not if they discover that those friends showed some awareness of the situation earlier. I'd rather not take that risk. We've a plenty as is.
End of side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.